And I thought, why do we only talk about one kind of deficit? And then a number of you raised different deficits. But still, why is it that it has to be the United Steelworkers Union and another employer that week after week, month after month, are spending huge amounts of money to take trade cases to the International Trade Commission and prove that our trading partners are violating the law? Why isn't that the role of our government? Why isn't our government that's enforcing our laws? I would love to be able to engage my brother, who would be my policeman when I'm driving my car, so that when I'm speeding, he'd say, well, Leo, you ought to slow down. Okay, that would be a cool thing. That's the equivalent of what our government is doing. While our economic roots are being ripped out, our government is saying to the Chinese and to the others, you ought to slow down. Let me tell you about the tire case. You heard someone mention the tire case. And I suspect this will end up in some blog somewhere, but what the hell, the case is over. The tire companies didn't want to step forward on the case. And I was asked at the ITC, well, why wouldn't the tire companies be here at the International Trade Commission? And I said, well, I have two options here. I can either lie or I can tell you the truth, so I'm going to tell you the truth. The truth is that they don't want to be here because they're afraid of Chinese retaliation. They don't have to say it, I'll say it for you. Cooper Tire, in fact, showed up and they testified. It's the Chinese calling, yeah. Michael Wessel on the China Commission warned me they could do this. The Cooper Tire testified at the USTR hearings in opposition to the tire case, an American company. We found out why they did that. And this will verify what Sister Bartholomew said. If you're going to put a plant in China and get capitalized in China, somewhere between 80% and 100% of your product for the first 5 years at Cooper Tire had to be for export. Now, let me ask you a question. At what other tribunal could you openly testify that you were violating the law and have your government stay silent? That was the testimony of the female chair, and it wouldn't matter whether it was female or male, chair of the Chinese Tire and Rubber Commission in front of the USTR hearings on the tire case that we brought forward. She testified that it's China's preference that when they attract a foreign company to China, that for the first 5 years, between 80% and 100% of their product be targeted for export. That is a clear, consistent violation of World Trade Organization rules, and they were confident enough to testify to that right in the USTR building. That's 5 months ago. Not one thing has happened yet. So when people say to me, what do we need to do to put American manufacturing back in the right direction? We can go through a litany of stuff, and we've done that. Instead of a 2-year stimulus program, we ought to have a multi-year economic renewal program. Instead of having, watch my mouth, my daughter warned me. Instead of having the Wall Street banks get taxpayer dollars and get fed money at a quarter or a half a percent of interest and then loan it out to others at 8, 9, 10, 12, 13%, or to tell us that if we miss a payment after we get laid off on our credit card, they'll juice you up to 30%. When I was a kid, if you were charging someone 30%, the cops came. You know? Now we honor them as Employee of the Year. No? So, I could go through a litany of those things that we could do, but you've got a litany of them throughout the day today. I just want to reiterate to you, service jobs are good, but they don't really create real wealth. You create real wealth by taking raw material, taking energy and creativity, innovation, hard work, decent family circumstances, decent working conditions, and putting that together to make something that adds value, then selling that to someone else that wants it. We cannot continue, impossible, to run an annual trade deficit of 700 or 800 billion a year. As Carolyn said, 1.7 trillion since China joined the so-called WTO, and think that we're going to be able to get our way out of this mess. It's not going to happen. And the only way that's going to be changed is to have people like Earl, Sherrod Brown, Governor Rendell, who I want to say something about before I sit down, helping us move in a direction that understands that real wealth is created by making things and enforcing the rules, and when the rules are inadequate, changing them so that they become adequate, so that people can know that they can work with dignity and raise their family, and if their child or grandchild can have a decent job, making a decent living and take care of their family. That's the American dream. We can't let the American dream get turned into the nightmare for the next generation. I can talk about green jobs. What's a green job? I'll tell you what a green job is. A green job is when the governor attracts a wind turbine manufacturer to Pennsylvania, and when that wind turbine manufacturer starts manufacturing turbines, that you open a plate mill that had been shut and 300 people go to work making plate for the wind turbine. Those folks in that plate mill making that steel plate, that's green jobs. When we say that we're going to retrofit public buildings and private buildings and we're going to retrofit that to the current science, then we're going to invest in science and innovation to move to the next level of science so that whether it's Corning glass or Pilkington glass, they can make energy-efficient glass, and we can put energy-efficient glass in all of our buildings, and we can retrofit our air handling systems, and we can retrofit our energy systems so that we're using less energy and keeping the heat in the winter and the cold out. We can do that. Those are green jobs. Green jobs aren't just building wind turbines and biomass. If we retrofit all the coal-fired generating stations to the current science and say that's a goal, how much carbon will that take out of the air? If we say to people that we're going to stop importing Chinese steel that is as unsafe as the Chinese dog food we're importing, how many people in this room saw the TV this morning that the Bay Bridge fell down again? How many of you know that that Bay Bridge was segmented out so that they could avoid the Buy American provisions? It was segmented out in segments. It got bid by Chinese. The Chinese won every segment. They fabricated it in China, shipped it over, and as they started to install it, it's fallen down three times. I ain't driving my damn car over that bridge ever. So I'm not doing this in any... I want to be real clear about it. I'm a trade unionist first. And I'm not doing this in any way against Chinese workers or Brazilian workers or workers from everywhere. I'm doing it against the system that's exploiting Chinese workers as badly as it's damaging us. And I want to leave lots of time for my governor. He sometimes backs the wrong football team, at least it's from the other end of the state. Yeah. He occasionally backs the wrong hockey team, too, but what the hell. I could tell you, Governor, that we have rings in Pittsburgh. We got six rings for the Pittsburgh Steelers, Super Bowl rings. We have three Stanley Cup rings for the Pittsburgh Penguins. We got an order of onion rings for the Pirates. But I just want to make two more quick points. And if you detect a tone of resentment and bitterness in my voice, it's because it's there. And I just went through, and I'm still going through, a very gut-wrenching period of time in our union. and it's a public confession. We've lost 135,000 members since July of last year. Probably 110,000 of those are because of the economic collapse. Probably the other 20 or so thousand are because of rotten trade deals in that period of time. And you can follow sort of the life and times of the steelworkers by following which trade cases we're filing. As John Sermas, Ember, OTGC, pipe case, and our government, it's up to the steelworkers and the company to go fight about this. China has put more out-country tubular goods into the American market in the last year than all of the demand for out-country tubular goods in the nation. They've put it in reserve. It's in warehouses, waiting for the price to come back. And they don't care where the price comes and the demand comes, because their steel is going to be here. And if we can sell ours for a dollar, they'll sell theirs for 98 cents. And there's people in this room right there. I see Mickey Bolt. His plant is down. We lost 5,000 people so far since the last oil country tubular good case. We're going to be in front of the International Trade Commission on unfair subsidies for Chinese coated free sheet paper. As Carolyn Bartholomew said, you have to be on your knees. You have to prove that you're hurt. You almost have to prove that if you don't get relief, you'll go out of business. And you might even still go out of business. We lost 7,000 members in the coated sheet, free sheet paper sector of our union since we filed the case and won the case on subsidy at the Commerce Department. But the Commerce Department ruled and the ITC ruled that we weren't entitled to a remedy because we hadn't been injured yet. So now we're going back 2 years later and say, now we've lost 7,000 jobs. Now the same things are going on. Now not only are they violating the rules, but being injured. Now let me ask you, do you think that that's a fair set of trading rules? Why isn't our government initiating those cases rather than us? So as I say, I've gone through a really gut-wrenching and turbulent time in our union. We meet almost every day talking about survival strategies. 350,000 steelworkers make something that will end up in an automobile. We made the auto industry take a haircut like you wouldn't believe. We made those workers take a haircut like you wouldn't believe. While the guys on Wall Street got 100 cents on the dollar. And the same guys that ran those Wall Street companies into the ground and damn near destroyed the whole economy, not just of America, but of the industrialized world, would pay themselves the same fat bonuses as they would have a year ago if they were allowed to. The way I characterize this in my own sort of visual way, the deregulation of Wall Street was the economic equivalent of leaving three-year-olds alone in a candy store for days on end. And you know what'll happen? You'll come back. Their stomachs will be full of candy and sugar. It'll be coming out of their pockets. And as you're driving them home, they'll puke on your shoes. I don't want Wall Street puking on my shoes anymore. My last point is a challenge. As I said, we have 350,000 members that make something that will end up in an automobile. We have a big stake in a successful auto industry, an auto parts industry. Last year, in United States exported $2 billion worth of autos and auto parts to South Korea and Japan. Roughly $1 billion and a bit to Japan, a little bit less than $1 billion to South Korea. That sound good to you? Well, let me tell you what South Korea and Japan did in return for that generosity. South Korea exported roughly $8 billion worth of autos and auto parts to America. And Japan exported $42 billion worth of auto parts and autos to America. That's a $48 billion trade deficit with two countries in one product. Are we surprised that the auto industry is on its knees? Are we surprised that we lost 135,000 members? Probably not. But the last question, are you surprised that your government is silent about it? I've been relatively quiet about that. But it's an issue that our union is going to take up. And if we have to go back on the road, we'll do what we did before. We did 32 stops in 11 states in 4 days to highlight the job losses that were coming if we didn't stand up for the auto industry. It's about time we stood up for an industrial policy for America, but it's also a time that we stood up that while we're developing that industrial policy and while our president, who wants to do the right thing, is given the support by all of us so that he can do the right thing, and that the rules that were there and the quotes that came from FDR can be the same rules and the same quotes that we can someday have our kids read about what Barack Obama did and what the Democratic administration did in the House and the Senate when we had a Democratic majority. Nobody voted for a timid majority. We voted for change, and damn it all, we're entitled to it. Let me shut up and sit down. And before I do that, I got to say that I consider Ed Rendell, the steelworkers' best organizer, that we developed a partnership and a friendship while he was campaigning for governor, and we had a pretty animated exchange when we first met. But every commitment that he made during that campaign, he's lived up to. And I think of two times where he's called me. I think of a third time when he called me and gave me shit about an endorsement in the campaign, but that's, you know, that was another issue. Gamesa, he needed our help to do that, and we helped. And we helped him get the renewable energy standard, and we helped get his vision through for a bond issue and his vision through for rebuilding manufacturing. And I've considered him the best jobs governor in the United States. But also last summer, we were at our convention, and I was chairing the convention. We had 5,000 delegates almost, with delegates and observers, and my secretary came, pulled on my coat, and I said, "I'm chairing the convention. What do you want?" She said, "Governor Rendell's on the phone." I said, "Tell him I'm chairing the convention. I'll call as soon as I'm done." She goes away. She comes back. She says, "No, he said now." So I got a hold of Jim English, and I said, "Jim, chair, I've got to call Governor Rendell." So I stepped back. "Leo, this is your governor. I've got a guy in here that wants to put 300 jobs in Allegheny County. He needs to talk to you. You call him. You call me back. If you tell him that you'll do what he says, he'll call me back. And by the end of the day, you'll have 300 members." I jumped to it like mad dog. I called the guy. Tell him Governor Rendell said to call you. He asked me the question. I gave him the answer. I said, "Okay, I'm supposed to now tell you to call Governor Rendell." He calls Governor Rendell. I chair the convention. After I finish chairing the convention, I call Governor Rendell. He says, "Done deal. You got 300 new members. He's going to expand in western Pennsylvania." So let me introduce the best jobs governor in America, Governor Rendell.
Well, hello, everyone. Let me say what an honor it is to be on the panel with Leo and Earl. Earl is, as you can tell, a visionary, and he understands that if we're going to do something, we got to do it. There's no such thing about being half pregnant, and there's no such thing about doing what we need to do to produce a jobs economy, an industrial economy, to preserve and grow manufacturing, unless we do it at the right scale. I mean, infrastructure is one of the answers. It is absolutely one of the answers. You know how Leo's going to get some of those steel workers back? If we invest in a green economy. Gamesa alone produced 600 good union jobs, and it was wonderful that some of the people who went back to that closed steel mill, where Gamesa located in the eastern part of Pennsylvania, it was a closed U.S. Steel, Fairless Hill steel mill, Some of the people that Gamesa hired were workers who had worked at that steel mill 9 years before when it closed. It was a great, 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 great story. And we can do that with so much of green manufacturing. There's no question about that. But we can also do it with infrastructure. We have a steel plant right across from the Capitol, across the river in Harrisburg, in a little town called Steelton. It's run by ArcelorMittal right now, and its sole is on Detra. Its sole purpose for being is to produce railroad ties. If we built a high-speed railroad system in America, think of the steel railroad ties. The Ocelot people told me that even the modest, and it is modest, the president put $8 billion into the ARRA for high-speed rail, and I think there's $5 million of commitments or $4 million in the budget. That $12 billion won't even get you a third of the way across Pennsylvania. To build a high-speed rail line from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, which everyone agrees ought to be the first project. It ought to be the first project, because once you build it, it links to the Atlantic corridor to the Midwest. And once you build that, you have to build out everything else. That's why it should be the first project. But it'll cost $35 billion to do that. So all the money we have in is a third of what's necessary to build one high-speed rail line from Philadelphia to Pennsylvania. And by the way, high-speed rail is not $110 or $120 or $130 million a year. The problem with stimulus is we don't have the scope necessary, so as a result, we're going to putz around and we're going to waste $12 billion improving rail systems from 90 to 110 or 120 miles an hour. You land in the Shanghai airport and you take the high-speed train down to into central Shanghai, 325 miles an hour. 325 miles an hour.
You can get
those again. That's right. I'm saying the nice things about Leo now. I'm going to get to it. But think about what building out a high-speed rail system would do for jobs. We ought to, and Leo and Earl are both right, we ought to do, this is not even my subject, but we ought to do a 10-year, $3.5, $4 trillion infrastructure repair program. You think that's a ridiculous scale? Well, Germany and Japan, countries who are a quarter of our size, in the last 15 years have spent $1 trillion revitalizing their infrastructure. The Society of Civil Engineers, American Society of Civil Engineers, say we need $2.2 trillion just to keep what we have in decent condition. If we're going to build out a high-speed rail line, if we're going to increase roads, if we're going to do things that we need to do, we have to do it at the $3.5 to $4 trillion level. And just think for a minute about the jobs that that would produce. Analysts say that infrastructure, every $1 billion of infrastructure spending produces somewhere from a low of 20 to a high of 45,000 jobs. Just think if you did $4 trillion over 10 years, how many jobs that would be. And people say, well, they're construction jobs or they're manufacturing jobs, but they're temporary. Well, 10 years isn't temporary, folks. This would revitalize the American economy in ways that we couldn't imagine. And all that we need to do is have the guts to sell it to the American people. And one of the things I wanted to say about what Leo said, and I'm getting way ahead of myself, and I'm probably not going to ever get to my prepared remarks, but that's okay. Because they weren't all that good. But because I didn't write them. That's why they weren't all that good. But what we need to do is not work inside the Beltway. Earl will tell you, we could stand, and the group that I co-chair of with Governor Schwarzenegger and Mayor Bloomberg, we've done a good job in the Beltway raising the profile of infrastructure. Everybody knows what has to be done, but the Beltway, inside the Beltway, is never going to vote for infrastructure revitalization at the proper scale. It has to come from the American hometowns. U.S. Chamber of Commerce and NAM are for a massive infrastructure revitalization. They're for raising the gas tax. Doesn't mean a thing. Doesn't mean a thing. But if you're Senator Inhofe and the Oklahoma City Chamber of Commerce is for it, and the Norman Chamber of Commerce is for it, And the Rotarians and the Elks and all those folks are for it. And there are op-ed pieces that start cropping up in all the Oklahoma newspapers. Then all of a sudden, a guy who Senator Inhofe has a natural inclination for infrastructure. He said at a hearing that I testified in front of it that it's the second most important thing that America can spend money on. Defense is first, infrastructure is second. So it's there. Infrastructure used to be a big Republican issue 15 years ago. It's there if we can generate the pressure, if we can make people interested in this idea so the Beltway folks get the idea when they go back home. And it's doable. You know, Building America's Future took a whole lot of polls before the crash, and I emphasize before the crash. 81% of respondents said that they would pay 1% more in their federal income tax for a better infrastructure. 75% of McCain voters, 91% of Obama voters said that. Think about it. Now, that was before the crash and before we had to spend money on things that ran up the debt. I'm sure if you repolled, it wouldn't be nearly that good. But we took a second poll, and the second poll found people were generally against raising the gas tax, but, and I don't know if I didn't tell Earl this, 61% of Americans think the gas tax goes up every year indexed to inflation. Hasn't gone up since 1989. People have no clue what the gas tax is. They have no clue. Governor Tom Ridge, my predecessor, who's a fine guy, he, unlike most Republicans, had the guts to raise the gas tax. But Tom Ridge has always been, you know, in politics, like in life, it's good to be lucky rather than, you know. Tom Ridge was both lucky and smart. So he raises the gas tax at a time when oil prices drop through the floor. So after he raised the gas tax, prices at the pump went down. The people don't have a clue. When you drive into the gas station, you see those prices up there. It doesn't say what percentage of it is gas tax. People in New Jersey have no idea that the reason they pay 12% less, not 12%, 12 cents less a gallon than Pennsylvania is because they haven't raised their gas tax in years. And as a result, their infrastructure is in worse shape than anybody else's. So there are things that we can do, but we have to, look, we can decry China as much as we want. And part of my prepared speech was to decry them on a subject that I may get around to telling you about. But we can't just sit around and decry China. In some ways, we've got to emulate them. They're spending 10% of their GDP on infrastructure. Can you imagine if we spent 10% of our GDP on infrastructure? They're going to have, right now, we dominate the world in the production of wind power. China, by 2025, will be producing 4 times the megawatts of wind power than the U.S. is today. 4 times. So let's not just decry them, and we should decry them, and we should take action. Let's try to emulate them in certain things. Let's try to invest in our future the way they're investing in theirs. Now, before I get to my prepared remarks, I want to tell you one more thing about Leo. Leo supported, when I ran for governor the first time in the Democratic primary, he supported Bob Casey. And Bob Casey's a good guy, and he was a great friend of labor. Where I had the misfortune of being a mayor of a big city that was dead broke when I became mayor, and I had to have some interesting conversations with my municipal unions. So I was considered by some to be hard on labor, and Bob Casey was a friend of labor. So Leo supported Bob Casey, but I won the primary. And then I made an appointment to come see Leo, and I walked in the door, and I sat down, and as soon as my rear end had hit the seat, he said, oh, you were Al Gore's bagman, meaning my DNC chairmanship. And I thought, this can only go uphill. This can only go uphill. And truth be told, Leo and I have had a great relationship, and we've collaborated on a lot of things. And the way you get things done, the way we're going to get, and I want to talk about trade before I talk about the green energy economy, but I want to talk about trade for a minute. We have to change American attitudes. When Bill Clinton was president of the United States, America filed as many complaints against foreign countries in the ITC than were filed against us. When George Bush became president, we stopped filing complaints. We file about one-fifth of the complaints against foreign countries that they file against us. Is that because foreign countries improve their trade practices? Absolutely not. It's because as each year went on, China owns more and more of our debt. So we are. You talked, Leo, about those companies being scared to testify against China. Sometimes I think the great American government is scared to fight back against China. The great American government. And when I was listening to Leo tell some of the stories about China, I remember what they did to the pipe industry. And John Surma, Leo Gerard, both of our senators, myself, we went to the Bush administration and said, look, it's easy. They're violating. Drop the quota card. It's the only way we're going to save pipe jobs in America. And it took us about 4 years. And when they finally did drop the quota card, it was too late for 5,000 Pennsylvanians who worked in the pipe industry. Too late. Did it help? I'm not even sure. But it was too late. And we've got to get together and change attitudes. Look, free trade is, in fact, good for America and the world, but it has to be fair trade. It has to be fair trade. And you've got to tell people, again, in those Rotary clubs, in the Elks clubs, in the Moose Lodges, and in the chambers back home, you've got to tell people, everyone, Americans, oh, we want the lowest prices and we want the biggest selection. You've got to tell people that it matters what you do. It matters what you purchase. It matters, you know. Don't decry that Joe and Tom, your nephew and your brother are out of work and then continue buying stuff that isn't very safe and isn't very well made because it's cheaper. So we got a lot of work to do. And the work has to be done in hometowns. The work has to be done outside the Beltway. They're never going to change here unless they feel a compelling need. Now, I want to talk, and I'll run through this much more briefly than I had expected to. I want to talk a little bit about one of the ways that I think we can help solve a problem or begin the road back. We ought to be, let's start with the proposition, the United States of America ought to be the leader in the green economy. We ought to be exporting our skill, our talent, our products. If one of these super batteries is going to get made, it ought to be made in the United States, and we ought to be selling it to China. We ought to incentivize the production of technology in this country and the green economy so that we begin to be the exporter of green technology, green jobs, green manufactured goods. And we can do it, and there are ways to do it. Let me just rip through this. No, you don't need to hear this. You don't need to hear that. Oh, I'm getting to it, Leo. I'm getting to it. I believe we need to do basically three things as a country. And many of these things have been done by the states, and I am going to talk about what Pennsylvania has done first. I think the United States and the Recovery Act has done some of this. It's a great start. The United States has to invest in renewable energy sources and cutting-edge technologies like carbon capture and storage. We are the Saudi Arabia of coal. We are the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. Now, neither of those is renewable, and I still think most of our emphasis ought to be on renewable energy. But we can't ignore those two things. If I were king of the world or king of the U.S., I would make sure that we were spending every dime that isn't tied down trying to find a way to successfully and economically, feasibly capture and sequester carbon. Because if we do that, we unlock an industry that's primarily American. We are the Saudi Arabia of coal. If we can capture and sequester, coal becomes clean. And I know there are people probably in this audience who think that clean coal is an oxymoron. It isn't. It doesn't have to be. And there are tons of great American manufacturing, family-sustaining jobs that could come from unlocking clean coal technology. We ought to be using natural gas. There is more natural gas under the Marcellus Shale. There's enough natural gas under the Marcellus Shale, which runs all through Appalachia. Just coincidentally, the majority of it is in Pennsylvania. But there is more natural gas there There's enough to keep the American economy running for the next 20 years. And we have to invest in, again, things like dealing with the frack water that comes from breaking up the shale itself to get the gas out. It's all about technology. We ought to be investing. Anybody here think Boone Pickens is crazy? He's crazy like a fox. And he's got it right. Natural gas is our bridge to the future. It's the way to stop exporting all that money to bring in foreign oil. Money that goes to countries that finance terrorists against us. Natural gas is a way to create a lot of good American jobs right now. I'm for wind, I'm for solar, I'm for hydro. Canada produces 50% of its electricity from hydro. We produce 7% of our electricity from hydro. Why? Because hydro has been stopped in this country because of the damage it does to aquamarine life. Well, the good news is the technology's improved. I saw a giant turbine. I don't know if your guys produced it at Voith Hydro down in York, a giant turbine, and they have the technology has arranged it now that fish can safely pass through the turbine. And Pennsylvania has just permitted the first new hydro project in Pennsylvania in years and years and years. And it's going to be dramatically successful. And Voith Hydro, when I visited it in 06, didn't sell one dime worth of product in the U.S. Sold it in Canada, sold it in Germany, sold it in every other place. The good news is I visited it just a month ago. Voith Hydro is now selling in the U.S., has a major project in Oregon, and they've added 28% to their workforce during the recession. It's there. It's there. This is gold, every bit of it, renewable energy, et cetera. It is all gold. So number one, the United States should invest in incentivizing. The stimulus is doing that. It's a good start. But again, Leo's right. The stimulus is a one-shot. We've got to make sure the stimulus is sustained. Secondly, we've got to encourage energy conservation and efficiency. We've got to do that because if all of the stuff I just said happens at a great pace, we still will not meet demand in the world by 2025. We have to reduce consumption. And the good news is there are jobs in energy conservation. There are jobs in energy efficiency. There are good jobs, and we need to do that as a federal policy. Third, we need to create markets for renewables and alternatives. And we can do that by passing something called Alternative Energy Portfolio Standards, AEPS. Pennsylvania became the 23rd state to pass it. And we passed the most aggressive solar photovoltaic standard of any state in the nation. Absolutely. We need the Congress to pass a U.S. Advanced Energy Portfolio Standard. For those of you who don't know what it is, it basically creates a mandate. In Pennsylvania, by the year 2019, 20% of the electricity sold at retail, meaning sold to homeowners, sold to commercial establishments, sold to manufacturing businesses, 20% of it must come from designated alternative and renewable sources. Each state makes it a little different. Pennsylvania, clean coal is on our list. In other states, clean coal wouldn't be on the list. But the wind and solar and hydro and geothermal are on everybody's list. The Congress has been, what did the Republicans say, has been dithering with a national portfolio standard for a long time. But fortunately, we have a president that gets it. President Obama wants our standard to be 25% by the year 2025. That would have an incredible effect because it creates a built-in market. And that means Wall Street and others invest in these companies because they know they've got a built-in market. They know they can't fail. It's like if I go to a bank and I'm a shopping center developer and I show them leases for 100% of my shopping center, and I show them the prices and the leases, the bank looks at it and says, this guy can't fail. We're going to lend him the money. And we build the market. There's a second way we can build the market, and this goes back to Boone Pickens. If every governmental subdivision in the United States that has vehicles, it's everybody, it's the littlest township, the littlest boroughs, cities, counties, states, and the federal government, if all of us, by 5 years from now, if we all dedicated ourselves to converting to natural gas vehicles, what would that do to the natural gas industry? First of all, why won't sir, why won't you buy a natural gas vehicle? You don't have to answer. The answer is you can't find any place to fuel up. But if every government car in the nation was natural gas, there would be natural gas stations popping up everywhere. We create the market. We're the biggest off-takers in the world, the government, in the United States of America. Let's use our buying power to stimulate something that doesn't create jobs in Saudi Arabia or in Iraq or Iran, but that creates jobs in Erie and Pittsburgh and Chicago and Detroit and Atlanta and places like that. We can do it. Let's use our buying power. We let our buying power be used to promote countries all over the world. Let's use our promote American jobs and good family-sustaining jobs. Simple as that. Now, I want to just take a minute to do a little, after saying all those things about emulating China, I want to do a little China bashing myself here. China is increasingly holding the cards in our energy independence strategy. Not only does the China fuel our oil addiction by lending us all this money, which we borrow from the Chinese, send it to the Saudis, but they are responsible for 93% of the production of so-called rare earth elements. How many of you have heard of rare earth elements? Good for you. This is a very withered group. They're responsible for 93% of it. A single mine in China's Inner Mongolia produces half of the world's rare earths. The rest of it comes from small, often unlicensed mines in southern China. Rare earth elements are used in the production of everything from wind elements to Prius cars. They're absolutely essential for the manufacturing green energy economy. In each of the last 3 years, China has systematically reduced the amount of rare earths that can be exported. Systematically reduced it. This year's export quotas are on track to be the smallest yet, and may be reduced even further in the future. Why is China doing this? Because they want to keep all of the rare earth elements for themselves, because they want to produce all things and make us buy them, and make us buy them. So, we have to be aggressive. The effects of this are already showing. Consider that in the year 2000, 9 years ago, U.S. companies held about 30% of the solar manufacturing share of the world. Today, we hold 6%. China and India are getting serious about expanding the amount of electricity they use from renewable sources. China has set a standard of 8% for 2020 for solar and wind. 8% for solar and wind is an extraordinary target. India is pushing to install 20 gigawatts of solar energy by 2020. The nation of India has virtually no capacity for solar energy today. But if they did that, that would be 75% of the world's expected solar capacity by 2020, which is 27 gigawatts. We better get on the stick. There's no time to waste here. This is a race. And like in all races, because of our unwillingness to invest, our unwillingness to be bold, our unwillingness to create a strong vision, we're getting our butts kicked and time is running out. Let me close by telling you what one, not little state, Pennsylvania, if it were a standalone nation, would have the 19th largest economy in the world. But let me tell you what we've done. As I said, we enacted an aggressive alternative energy portfolio standard. We also did something which very few states have done. We have enacted a biofuels mandate. Pennsylvania sells at the pump 11.4 billion gallons of gasoline. We're a huge pass-through state. We have twice as many miles of highways as New York and New Jersey combined, even though we have half the people of New York and New Jersey, because we're an east-west pass-through state. 11.4 billion gallons. We have enacted a law that says by 2012 or earlier, depending on the distribution network, that 1 billion of those gallons must come from biofuels. 1 billion. And those biofuels have to be produced where? Who said Indianapolis? In Pennsylvania, of course. 1 billion produced in Pennsylvania. And we can do it. It's not that hard. We can do it. We can do it. We're talking about ethanol and preferably cellulosic ethanol. We're talking about biodiesel. Things that we can do. We use soy. We use diesel, we use switchgrass, we use plant grass, we use wood chips. Those are the things that can produce fuel, and they're all there. Wood, agricultural waste, switchgrass, plant grass. Pennsylvania, we have a ton of animal waste. We're a forest. We have plant grass. We have it all. And we can do that. And this is a mandate to ensure we do. Third, we have passed last year the most ambitious, or second behind California, the most ambitious energy conservation mandate in the country, which also mitigates climate change. Our mandate says that by 2012, the utilities must reduce consumption by 3% or pay large and significant fines. And in that industry, there are tons of new jobs that are going to be produced in the conservation industry. We've already spent $1 billion incentivizing alternative and renewable energy companies, but last year we also produced another $650 million bond for alternative energy investment fund. We believe that alone will account for another 10,000 green energy jobs. It'll attract over $3.5 billion in private investments. So far, in a short period of time, we've produced 9,000 good-paying jobs in the renewable and alternative energy industry. The Pew Charitable Trust just released a study that ranks us third in the nation behind only California and Texas in the number of green energy jobs. But we're not satisfied where we are. We're going to keep going and going and going. And I don't know if anybody has told the conference yet, but today President Obama announced $3.4 billion of stimulus grants to help build out the electricity grid and promote conservation and efficiency. I passed up to be here with Leo because I knew how badly Leo would trash me if I didn't come. A chance to be with Secretary Chu in Philadelphia announcing $250 million in grants of that 3.4 going to Pennsylvania will create 700,000, will place 700,000 smart meters in Pennsylvania homes. It will help us, build out a grid, and we have a very good grid with PJM. I don't know if any of you remember 4 years ago when we had the blackout around the country. It stopped in Pennsylvania because PJM has good people running and a pretty good system. But our system can be better. We've got to build out our capacity. We've got to build out our capacity because as we're building all these new sources, as we're trying to create new sources of electricity, the grid has to be able to support it. So there's work to be done. Time's running out. We're not alone. The competition is enormous. We know what needs to be done. The science is here. The technology is here. The question is, do we have the will to create the type of energy economy that can answer a lot of those problems, that can put a lot of those steelworkers back to work? I think we do. And ladies and gentlemen, let me say, and this is a prediction which I don't think anybody in the room will contradict me, if the time comes that we become a nation that produces nothing, we will be a second or third-rate economic power. The time of American economic dominance in this world is fast drawing to a close. As American manufacturing withers, as we stop producing significant things that are important to the world, it not only will have disastrous effects on our national security, think of an America without a steel industry going to war again. Think about that. Think about what we did in World War II because of our steel industry. Think about how quickly we ramped up. Think about Rosie the Riveter. Think about all of those things. If we don't produce anything, we're laying ourselves powerless. And economically, it'll be disaster. So please, just don't attend this conference. Just don't tell some friends over dinner what a great conference it was. Get motivated. Write op-ed pieces in your local newspapers. See if you can get listed as a speaker at a Rotarian Club. Let's get a groundswell going. Sound the clarion call to the American people. Let them know what trouble we're in. And let them know that we can, as we always have, in moments of great challenge, we can rise to the occasion. We can use American ingenuity and innovation and skill and technology and drive and the willingness to keep going ahead and build a better life for ourselves and our kids and our grandkids. We can do all those things. But time's running out. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank Governor Rendell, Leo Gerard, Congressman Blumenauer, who did have to leave to go back to the Hill. Just a couple of things before you leave today. Wanted to thank you all for coming. We do have some copies of our book available outside at a discounted rate. Otherwise, you can get it on Amazon.com or other online booksellers. I want to thank the great partnership we've had with Campaign for America's Future and Bob Borisage, and want to have him close the program out now. Bob?
I'm not going to even try to follow those three speeches, but I do want you all to give a hand to Jen Gonzalez, who organized this conference for us and really done a terrific job. She is our secret weapon at the Campaign for America's Future. I'd also like a round of applause for the Local 25 of the HERE workers who served us our lunches today, and Local 99 of the engineers that made sure that all this worked. Leo wants to see all the steel workers, so don't leave if you're a steel worker. You've got work to do. And otherwise, make sure you're signed up. If you haven't signed up, we want your email. We're going to stay on this. We're going to blog about it and write about it. We have to make this a debate that moves forward. Thank you all very much.
And there you have it. A good 7 solid hours of policy discussion.
No gavel.
No gavel.
We told people we were doing gavel-to-gavel coverage of this today, and we lied on both ends. There was never a gavel.
Will somebody find a gavel, please?
That's what we
say. Okay, there's
thank
your
gavel. We've had the gavel.
But it has been gavel-to-gavel coverage.
Yes, it has.
Sans gavel.
In a manner of speaking, yes.
And I'm really, I'm quite excited by what I've heard, Guy. The breadth of discussion, the China discussion, the green energy discussion, I kind of get I get a lot bent out of shape whenever I hear coal, because there's no such thing as clean, there are no purple unicorns either, because there are no unicorns. Coal can't be clean.
Well, I get bent out of shape when we talking about green jobs, and they start telling us that all the green jobs are going to be in China,
But it's a function of the failure of our national will, isn't it?
It is.
And frankly, if you want to talk about a failure of national will, you're talking about a failure of leadership. And if you want to talk about a failure of leadership, how does that not just go right home and roost on the doorstep of the Repig-Lickin' Party?
It does. It does. It a lot of it has to do with the American people as well. We had this discussion this morning, you and I, about Walmart. We had a national boycott of Walmart where they sell all these Chinese goods. If Americans had more pride in their own country, instead of buying crap at Walmart made in China. So I think there's a little bit of it to go around. Sue me, Walmart. Go ahead.
Twice. Yeah. I'm in for that. But overall, at least we're talking about it, and at least we're thinking about it, Guy.
That's true. We are thinking about it. You and I think about it. I know our audience thinks about it. The activists that they are, and the concerned citizens that they are, and the very well-informed citizens they are. I'm not buttering them up when I say that. It's amazing to me how many times when you're doing your show, I'm doing my show, we'll come up with something, and bam, on the chat room, here comes the answer right away that, hey, we knew that,
Oh, yeah, and God forbid we should screw up. They're on us like ducks on June
bugs. Oh, man.
But the truth of the matter is we are talking about it, and the next step beyond that is to keep talking about it. I know that may sound a little bit silly, but it's to take the discussion outside rooms like this and to take it into hometown America and to take it into living rooms and to take it into the line at the grocery store and to take it into the conversation at the gas pump. I know I've said this a million times.
And how do we do that, Bob? How do we do that? What's the main way to do that? What's the most efficient way to do that?
Radio.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Radio. But does the Democratic Party, do the liberals, do the progressives, do they get that? No.
No. What is this radio? This radio confuses me.
Yes. Let's all complain about the right-wing media being on 24/7 on the radio. Let's complain about that. But when it comes to supporting radio on the left, not so much. No. Yeah.
But you know what? We're taking that first bold step. We're taking a bite out of it. The coverage of this event live only happened on the Horn. The Horn is the future.
Well, it is. There's no question about it. But you and I are no special soothsayers. It didn't take much for you and I to figure that out.
Oh, so saith the soothsayer.
Why doesn't the leadership of the party understand that? I get furious when I think about that. I do.
Well, I know, and it's frustrating in the extreme. But we're beginning. But we, in our own right, are beginning that dialogue, Guy, because we've had that conversation with a lot of people who are willing to listen and are interested in what's being said and actually understand and agree.
We've had that conversation last night and today,
and we will probably continue having it this afternoon.
Yeah, after my nap.
Oh, there's a nap involved?
I think there may be.
You with the little. Ambient noise air conditioner machine?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You know what? You're going to forget that one of these days when you pack, and I'm going to be so happy because it's going home with me.
Yeah, and you know that came from a Sharper Image, and they're not in business
anymore.
And
they don't exist anymore. I know. It's the neatest. How many different sounds does that thing make?
I don't know, about 20.
And whatever sounds it's making, it is loud enough, but not annoyingly loud enough, but loud enough to drown out either of us snoring.
Yes, that and any outside noise, kids screaming in the next room,
sirens,
couples, murders, lots of things.
Yeah, I mean, we're in D.C., man.
Yes, we are.
Our window looks out on a really, really dodgy alley in Chinatown.
In Chinatown, yes. But
forget about it, Bob. Well, it's Chinatown.
What do you think? What do you think? We're going to do the Chinatown thing again tonight?
Thai
food?
Yeah, maybe we'll start with the little Japanese place, and then we'll for the appetizer.
It always comes back to that, doesn't it?
And then we'll move next door to the Thai food.
People would think we're obsessed with.
With what?
Culinary delights.
Well, you know, I don't know about you, but, I mean, because you come from civilization, even though it's got a lot of right wingers in it. I don't live in a place that has a wide variety of food choices.
Oh, Amy just handed us a note. Amy, sit down a minute, will you?
Unless you're in a drop-dead hurry, I mean...
Amy, are you on the run? You got to catch a plane or anything?
I have a train to catch, but I'm supposed to be meeting someone. But
what time? You got 5 minutes.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
See, we got it. This is how it is. We have to beg for interviews.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. There you go. Just grab that thing. It's live. Say hello, Amy.
Wait. Let me help you say hello, Amy. Now say hello, Amy.
Hi, this is Amy Ringenbach from Philadelphia and King of Prussia.
And King of Prussia.
Well, I live in King of Prussia, but I do a lot of things in Philly.
King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. So you're a Phillies fan, no doubt.
Well, as a matter of fact, this morning I was debating whether I should wear my pink Phillies 2008 World Series hat. And I promised two friends that I would. So you'll both agree that I'm wearing it.
You
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Are.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah. It's great looking.
And
too.
You know, you got a good reason to be wearing it too after last night.
We took pictures of it, but we're out of film. But it does look great.
The card's full.
Amy, why did you come here today?
I am reinventing myself, and I need to educate myself about the green economy and what's at stake. I had worked in the computer software industry, and a combination of the credit default swap debacle and increased overseas development gave me the door after 23 years. And I have PR in my background, and I thought, I need to come here to learn what I don't know and how I can key into the green economy and what's out there and how I can communicate it.
You do some writing?
Yeah, I do.
Where?
I have been writing what are called diary pieces on Fire Dog Lake.
Yes.
And I'm a coordinator for MoveOn in Philadelphia. And the Move On people tell me they love me. They love my emails.
Well, you've been around the block a time or two then politically. What are you taking away from here today?
I think the sharpest image I have today is that our government is afraid to challenge China for its inequities. China holds most of our debt, and yet with the way they've been bending the trade rules, we're afraid to yell at them.
Okay, so you got a big mortgage on your house. Do you go down to the bank where you owe the mortgage and say, hey, you dirty, rotten, no good?
Well, now that's a funny question to ask, because I know right now that there's some scuttlebutt, at least in Washington, although I don't think it's hit any legislation, because housing prices have dropped so much. I'm sure you've read about it, that there is some movement now to renegotiate house values because the markets fell apart. So there's a possibility that could be done. Whether it's going to happen, I don't know.
So we renegotiate with the Chinese over the 1.7 trillion.
Well, I don't know what the solution is. What I also heard today was that we're not doing enough to create the engineers we need.
We're not educating. But let me interrupt for just a moment, if I may, Amy, and submit that the words of Georges Santayana ring true. And that is that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it.
Absolutely.
And the first thing we have to do is understand how we got to where we are. Most favored nation trade status with China is something that never should have happened. And secondly, we just had eight long, tormented, tortured, miserable years of the George W. Bush administration hanging bad paper all over China. That's why they've got the leverage they have. They've got the leverage they have because we gave them the leverage they have, and we gave them the leverage they have because you've got to remember that George Bush's daddy's brother was the head of the United States China Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, Carlyle Group.
Hello. Hallelujah. Amy, thank you so much.
Yeah, go catch that train. Get out of here. Beat
all
it.
Right.
And go Phils.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Bob, and she
God,
does look
so
really nice in that pink.
It's a great hat.
Yeah, great pink. And that'll be in the archives if you on the you know. So.
All right. Thank you, Amy. And coming up, we're going to be speaking with Eric Locke, and he is research director of the.
Well, we were going to speak to him before he ran away.
Let me check on this here.
Have a seat, Eric.
Sit right down. Grab the microphone, Eric. Welcome. I'm Bob.
I'm Eric. What are we talking about? This is my report, and that's my book.
Well, we're talking about what you're talking about then.
we have spoken about your book on our shows. It's a pleasure to have you with us this afternoon. Oh, Bob wants to.
I think there's. We can share.
I guess so.
Do I have a headphone on or something?
No, if you can hear us, you're great.
Okay. Who am I talking to, by the way?
Oh, I'm Bob Kincaid.
But I mean, because Isaiah said, go talk to these folks.
Guy James, the head on Radio
Guy
Network.
James,
the Horn.
Yes, I've talked to you before.
Right.
Yeah.
Eric and I are old friends, actually. We went to school together.
Oh, all right. No, America's oldest liberal talk radio network, so, you know.
We are, in fact.
Okay. But you have a report out. You're also a novelist.
That's true.
Wow.
Fiction and nonfiction. Nonfiction is my career. Talking at my day job as the research director of the Campaign for America's Future. We're talking about manufacturing, the new green economy. We're talking about revitalizing the American economy. And then in my night job, if you will, I am a novelist, and I wrote this novel, 2044.
You know, I have talked about this on. We've never spoken, and it's kind of like a magician's agent. We've never met before, have we? I've talked about the novel because I've seen it excerpted on the web, and it's a brilliant premise. Talk a little bit about that as well as the report.
Thank you. I do appreciate that. The novel called 2044. starts with 1984, George Orwell's 1984. You remember, Big Brother is watching you, the Leviathan government out of control. It's the government that's running the show. And I said, wait a minute, it didn't turn out that way. It's not the government that got out of control. It's the private sector that got out of control. It's not Big Brother, it's Big Brother Incorporated. They're the people who are calling the shots in Washington and in the economy and all the rest of it. Someone should write a sequel to 1984.
And that someone was you.
It's called 2044, and it's about Big Brother Incorporated, and that's the problem.
So those uniforms we'll all be wearing someday in the future that we see in the movies, they'll have AIG and Bank of America and that names on them.
And your football team will be AIG and
which is straight out of Rollerball.
This is not completely original. I'm not the first person to be suspicious of the private sector. What I did is I skated it out to the extreme. And so, yes, the football team will be from the corporation. And right now we all have the Blackberries and we walk around. We're on call all the time. In that era, you will have a little shocker, a little electric chip in your thigh. And when you're the boss wants you, he'll just zap you.
Oh, man, I don't like to be shocked.
Well, we're not supposed to like this future, and we're supposed to say, wait a minute, let's take it back. Let's get the democracy working against the corporations. Let's get the people people asserting themselves in a more positive way, and we don't all have to be worker bees who get shocked by the boss when he calls.
How's it going with the book?
It's going well. It's getting good attention. The people who read it like it. It's getting good attention. The trouble is there's no advertising budget. I don't have a corporate backer, and I got to get people to know about it.
You don't have anybody to buy 50,000 copies at a time like certain other people do?
And my kids say to me, how come when I go into the bookstore, I see that bookstore right there on display, and how come I don't see yours? And, well, because Random House owns the place, and the big companies own the place.
So there is a direct website for the book, 2044 in numbers, 2044thenovel.com. But I imagine that since you've extrapolated out this rather horrifying corporate future, it's based on your day job as research director of the CAF, the Center for... Institute for America's Future. The IAF. I know. Campaign
for America's Future, Institute for America's Future. It's all
right.
It's
merges.
All good.
But anyway, as a result of what you have seen in the course of your research, that must be the basis that you relied upon in order to extrapolate out that rather terrifying future.
Very much so. I mean, the terrifying future, 2044thenovel.com, it's a straight-out extrapolation to what I see around us right now. Look at energy, look at health care, look at what's going on in the economy. You know, people are worried about the government-controlled health care. You don't want the government to take over health care.
No, keep their hands off my Medicare.
Keep your hands off my Medicare. And what we have right now, it's the private insurance company who's running your health care, and how are they doing? And it's ExxonMobil who's running our energy policy, and how are they doing?
Not bad.
And it's the big corporations that are buying the campaigns and buying the Congress folks. And so,
obviously,
yes, it is a very straight-out, linear extrapolation from what I see in my day job. Pick your issue area, energy, healthcare, agriculture, you name it.
He said buying some of their congresspeople?
Yes.
You couldn't mean that.
Well, you know, the report begins with a trenchant phrase that I heard a number of times this morning and this afternoon, that we can't go back, we can't pull out of the present downturn and return to the economy of the past. The economy of the past, it's not that it won't be, it simply cannot be the economy of the future. Do I have that right?
People call it the bubble economy. And, you know, there's one-upmanship going on here. I wish I could credit the person because I didn't make this up myself. It's not the bubble economy. It's the shampoo economy. The shampoo economy. Bubble, bust, repeat.
Yeah.
Bubble, bust, repeat. The NASDAQ bubble, the housing bubble, the commodity bubble, bubble, bust, repeat. And this isn't like, look at this crisis. Let's come out. Let's reinflate the bubble. What's the next bubble going to be? And let's all get high and watch the Dow go up maybe to 12,000 next time. And then poof, down to 6,000, whatever it's going to be. And all the time, working class wages are flat or dropping. Living expenses are chewing up more and more of regular people's wages and income. And maybe the bubble inflates, but regular people don't even enjoy the inflation part.
And, you know, it occurs to me, Eric, and tell me if I'm wrong, but we're not talking about something that's a uniquely American phenomenon necessarily. I think in particular to the Dutch tulip bubble. This is an economic phenomenon that exists in a sort of Western civilization type of thing. You can trace examples of it back into the ancient world as well. So you're really talking about the development and redefinition of an entire paradigm, aren't you?
Well, I want to answer that twice. I want to say, yes, you're right. We've had these cycles. We've had booms and busts. You got to learn from history so you don't repeat the mistakes. And I think you're right where you're coming from. There's another piece, too, which is, you know, I'm a critic and I'm a progressive, but there's this conservative part of me that just says, no, we just need to go back to basics. We need to go back to the economy we used to have, where we produced things and manufactured things, where we had schools for our kids. And this is not radical. This is not any kind of a reinvention. In many ways, this is a return to our roots of a productive economy where we had roads and bridges and factories. And that's what we need to go back to, not credit default swaps and these complex derivative instruments that make no sense to anybody. And we call that an economy.
Well, in that case, then, could we perhaps isolate as the problem that lies within what you've identified the lack of durability? You know, we hear about durable goods reports and things like that. Could part of the problem within the bubblicious nature of things lie in the incessant drive toward a disposable culture? You know, they're not antiques. They're still in service in my home, but I've got things that were built by American industry 60 and 70 years ago, and they are still in service, and they're still completely functional, and they're still completely useful, but they've obviously been replaced over time in general production by stuff that wears out faster, that you have to buy twice, and the second time you buy it, it's got a red knob instead of a blue knob. Do you see what I'm saying?
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. All of that's so well said. The bubblicious I kind of liked, and the durability crisis, just looking at this in terms of durability and disposability, that thing that you that breaks, you have to throw it out. There's no part to repair it, even if you wanted to repair it.
Microwave ovens are a case in point. I think the first one we had lasted 12 years. It was an Amana. It was made in the United States. The second, third, fourth, and fifth were all made in China, and not one of them lasted longer than 2 years.
Right. Well, I'm a farm boy, you know, and a lot of old Alice Chalmers and Massey Harris and Massey Ferguson and Ford tractors and International and John Deere, a lot of tractors back in my home stomping grounds today, 60, 70 years old, still running as good as they were the day they were bought. Good old American-made stuff. The new ones, not so much.
Right. Very much everything has moved towards disposability and not repair and short term, but somebody's profiting from that. And when you talk about the tractor that's been lasting all those years, well, compared to the one that doesn't last as long, well, what about the guy who sells the tractors? What about the company that made all those microwaves? And every other year you buy another microwave? Yay! Maybe we could get it down to 6 months.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Wouldn't that be great? And absolutely no replaceable or repairable parts. That sounds great to me. Let's go there.
And that's the consumer bubble.
That's the consumer bubble. And I'm being sarcastic. I'm being
sure.
The guy who's selling
right.
The things, and they want to sell them to you. And there's a lot of people, powerful people, with real interests here who like it the way it is. And this goes back to the financial industry, because these guys are getting a percent of every trade. And they don't really care what it is or where it came from. They just know that they're getting 1% of the activity. And so Goldman Sachs, they'll issue the bond, and they'll issue the bond to build the prison, or they'll issue the bond to build the high-speed railway. They don't care. They just want to issue the bonds.
Eric, I have to ask you a question. I've long wondered about this. So you're sitting in your office at Campaign for American Future, and you had your first cup of coffee or whatever you drink in the morning, if you drink anything.
Water,
please. And you're the
tap.
You're the research director.
Yes.
You sitting there waiting on somebody to come in and tell you, hey, here, I want some research on this. Is that how it works?
There's a push-pull, like in many places. In some cases, you know, the co-directors, Roger Hickey, Bob Borsig, or sometimes people like the Alliance of American Manufacturers, Leo Gerard at the Steelworkers, ideas from, I'm going to call them beyond me, will come to my desk with orders in terms of get this done. And maybe it's long time horizon, maybe it's get it done tomorrow, but the orders will come down from above saying get this done. And then in other cases, this is a job which does provide me the opportunity to say, hey, I think maybe we could do this, or what about that? And then it runs up the chain of command, and maybe I'll end up researching that or writing about that. The blog is especially free-spirited within the you know, the parameters of the kind of thing we talk about, the economy, that, you know, I wouldn't want to talk about sports, for example. Nothing against it, but not on our webpage. And so within the broad parameters of what we do, we have a good deal of freedom to blog. And so the blog can be much more, you know, ideas that I have or things that I want to talk about, consistent with the fact that there's something I'm actually assigned to be doing, like this report that's on for today's conference talking about rebuilding the real economy. The next report, we'll publish this sometime a few weeks from now, got to put some pieces into place, will be on workforce development, and it will be on community colleges and worker training. And there's actually, I use this quote in this report, this one, Building the New Economy, that we published today. And I'm quoting Barack Obama, and he talks about, we need education from the cradle to the career. And I kind of like that. I want to start using that, education from the cradle to the career. We need the pre-K. We need the K through 12, the basic primary education. And then we need the high-level education, the four-year college degrees, the PhDs. We need all of that. And we need the in-between. We need the community colleges, the two-year degree, the technical skills. I heard a little lament just walking around here around the conference. Somebody telling a story. I can't prove this is true. I trust the guy, but I don't know the company or what the story is. But it was a wind turbine manufacturer who needed to build some wind turbines, and he couldn't find people in his community who had the skills that he needed. And, you know, and there's some community colleges offering some degree programs or some on-the-job training in some industries, but basically this was an industry who wanted to put people to work and couldn't find the skills that this industry needed. This is green energy, this is wind turbines, it's the new economy, we're moving in that direction. We need the workforce development to go with it. We've got all of these people looking for work. It's not as if they're not willing to learn a new skill or not able to learn a new skill. And, you know, maybe it's 2 weeks of training, maybe it's 2 years of training, but the point is we need as a country to be thinking about workforce development and people learning and thinking and growing and acquiring new skills. I'm quoting Barack Obama again, from the cradle to the career.
Well,
we'll write a report on that. That'll be out 2 or 4 weeks from now, something like that.
Well, just as a little bit of a teaser, can we wait? Can we wait around for the private sector to figure out that it's needed, or is this something that we need to do as a function of government? I'm thinking in terms of the way education, for instance, in our high schools has changed over the last 40 years. Every boy used to take, and I don't care about gender roles, but every boy used to take woodshop, and every girl used to take home ec.
Right.
I don't care if the boys are taking home ec and the girls are taking woodshop, frankly. But as we look at this developing green energy future, do we need to start talking about things that go on in secondary education, things that, for instance, we started talking about on the horn a few months back. The idea that somewhere not too far down the road in the future, kids will be taking solar shop and wind shop and geo shop in high school as a means of skill development and exposure to the topic in order to see if that's something they want to go forward with as they further their education into whatever level that you've just described.
That's a great idea. I like to think that we will move forward in something like that way. And so I'm answering this twice. One, yes to the education, and then the deeper question where it really started, which is this a role for government? And the answer is yes, absolutely. This is what our government is for our collective problems that we all have as a society together. And this kind of public investment-led growth is where the economy needs to go, and it's something that that our government can do with our tax money. And we need to rebuild the roads, build the new rails, lay the new train lines, build the metro inside of the urban areas, the high-speed rail through the Northeast Corridor. And our government needs to take the lead in that regard. No private interest ever will, and no private interest can ever accumulate the couple of billion dollars that it takes in order to lay the new rail line. Our government needs to do it. Our government will put our people to work, many with our manufactured products, creating jobs to lay our rail lines, and that's the path to growth of the future. And yes, by the way, it's going to cost a bunch of money, and yes, it's going to run up the deficit in the short term, and yes, that's the way to grow the economy in the long term, like we did it in the good old days.
It sounds like you're rather stringently putting the lie to that tiresome old right-wing canard that, what did we hear? The government has never created a job. It sounds like there's plenty of jobs out there to be created.
To be created now and have been created in the past.
Right.
One thing that I've been learning in this conference and recently, New York City, you might have heard of it, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
It's maybe a little bit important to the American economy. More important, forgive me if I step on any toes, than Philadelphia or Boston or Atlanta or other good cities. And one of the things that happened way back then was the Erie Canal got built. And
yes,
the Erie Canal got built with public money, and not just because of geography, but because of this public investment, New York City became New York City, and Philadelphia didn't.
Yeah, because the seat of government was at both at one point in time. And then it winds up here.
Public investment has been very important to the American economy.
Well, the city that we're sitting in is a function of public investment. It was a city carved out of a swamp.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Some people would say it's still a swamp.
Some people would be right. Eric, we've got to wrap up here. But what a joy talking with you. I want to read 2044 myself. I'm an old science fiction geek, so I can't really help it. Thank you also for the work that went into today's conference and the information that was disseminated today. I'll be looking forward to the report that y'all get out in the next couple of weeks or next month or so. And if you are ever needing to scream from the housetops, please consider the horn to be a housetop that you want to climb the ladder to and scream from the loudest.
Thank you for having me here, but I don't want to scream. I want to talk politely, and I want to assume the intelligence of your listeners. I'm going to talk to them like the smart people that they are.
Exactly. You're talking to a liberal audience, so you are assuming correctly.
Thank you for having me.
Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric.
Take care.
Good to see you again. Well, see,
Rick Smith, get over here.
It's always fun to have people that know what they're talking about.
And one of our Horn colleagues is with us as well this afternoon. That would be you. That would be the chair. Go ye unto it.
And this would be the guy who's vacated.
All right. Take care, Eric. Rick Smith joins us now, our colleague from the weekend on the Horn. He of the Rick Smith Show comes your way about 5:15 p.m. Every Saturday. And the Sunday show as well. On Sunday, he operates out of generally the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area. He's a little bit of a tired guy. Now you don't sleep at all. You just sort of hang by your heels and then fly and flap away, right?
Yeah, it's good to see these kind of events, and this keeps you energized, keeps you moving, keeps you raring to go.
And so you drove down from Harrisburg today?
Yeah, we sure did. I got off work at 5 o'clock this morning. Worked 11 hours and drove down here. We spent the day listening to speeches and talking to people and networking.
What do you come away from this with?
Well, I think the obvious is that
besides the silverware and stuff. I mean,
I think the obvious is a need for an industrial policy, something that we've been sorely lacking for the last 30 years. And we need to invest in infrastructure. We have so many needs, and we're not doing these things.
So right, it's like industrial America has been almost forgotten, except for those who've been thrown out of their jobs. The people on Wall Street have forgotten about him. The politicians have forgotten about him. Joe Citizen that works down at the bank or anything but an industrial job has forgotten about the industrial sector. And damn it, they built America. And here we sit with,
How did we get, just as far as you're concerned, Rick, how did we get to a point in this country where there was something almost dishonorable about working in manufacturing or working in a real industry as opposed to a flim-flam job like investment banker? How did that happen?
Well, I got to be honest. I think of my grandfather, for instance. My grandfather was a truck driver his whole life. And the fact that I drive a truck now for a living to him was a failure. He saw the work that he did, you know, as he failed in letting me move ahead. I mean, from when you were, I think my generation especially, when we were kids, we were taught we were going to go to college, we were going to become doctors and lawyers and professionals, and we weren't going to have to do the hard back-breaking, dirty hand work that our parents had to do. And I think we, my generation especially, views ourselves as something better than that. And we've put that on our children as well, that you're moving, at least that's how I think. I think if you're not moving forward, if you're, somehow we've gotten away from
who does that assume is going to do the hard work?
Well, why do you think we've encouraged businesses to entice people to come across the border and work in horrible, exploitable conditions to clean our hotel rooms and to do the work that, you know, that corporations want to pay nothing to have done.
And I don't understand where they think it's necessarily, you said, move ahead. Yeah, dollar-wise, you get into some of these professions and make more money, but it's a perfectly honorable position to do any of the industrial jobs. I mean,
yeah,
whether
you're
run a lathe or pick up the garbage.
Somebody's not to take too much issue with what you're saying, but
you are taking issue.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I am. But Rick, I know you've talked about your own the arc of your own career. Jobs like what you're describing, if they are jobs with a good union representation, are actually trajectories into the middle class. I mean, that's
absolutely
been hammered home time after time after time. My father was a furnace operator. His father before him had been a slave to a coal company. It was an upward trajectory, and it was into the middle class, and that's where I grew up. And it wasn't because my dad was a doctor or a lawyer or a pharmacist or a banker. It was because he went to work every day around, 5,000 degrees of heat or whatever. And somehow or another, I can't get past the notion that it's almost as though some sort of cultural snobbery has taken hold of our country.
If you look at any of the primetime television programs, where is a positive working class role model? A guy from University of Massachusetts Amherst, Pepe Lestina, did a movie, like a short film a couple years ago, where he looked at the different working class images. And what you saw on television, you saw Ralph Cramden, you saw Fred Flintstone. You didn't see positive images. You saw people who were basically jokes.
Archie Bunker,
that was the other example he used. You didn't see the guy who went to work every day, busted his behind, supported his family, and did the things that millions of Americans do every single day to put food on the table and keep a roof over their heads. That isn't in our mainstream media. And, I still remember when I was a kid, you'd see movies of people saying, well, if I could just get a union job, then, I'd be okay. You don't see that anymore. Now unions have been assaulted. They've been demoralized, demeaned, and perverted. And you can blame the people like Limbaugh. You can blame the people like Hannity. But at the end of the day, it's people like you and I who allow it to happen.
That's cold
silence.
No, that's tough. I mean, that's tough to swallow.
Well, it is. I mean,
it's not people like you and I.
Well, it's working class people.
It's working class people.
It's all of us. It's the 62% of the people who go to work every day and punch a clock, who have been divided and sliced and diced by the wealthy in this country. People who have figured out that it's easy to divide and conquer us, and we've been conquered. I don't know if you've figured it out. If you look at the teabag parties, we're being conquered.
Well, we very clearly are. Do you see it coming out of this? Do you see a way forward?
The only way forward, Bob, is you and I sitting down and having conversations with people. The only way forward is to engage your neighbors. The only way forward is to continue to find common ground. I mean, I had a guest on this past weekend who said the sad thing that he's seeing that the polar opposites don't seem to like each other. You know, and he gave the example of Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Maybe they fought and they went at each other, but at the end of the day, they sat down and had an Irish whiskey together. We don't do that anymore. If you're on the right and you're on the left, you don't go and have a beer anymore.
That's true.
And that's distressing. And as I've said on my program, I don't think things change until people are really, honestly, and truthfully hurting. And I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we've had enough pain. You go back to the Depression. And again, you can disagree with me.
No.
There was mass pain. And that mass pain brought the working class together.
Before the Depression even struck, there was a reason that my grandfather and my great-grandfather were willing to take the life-threatening step of joining the United Mine Workers.
Yep.
They didn't do it because they had a really nice lodge hall with darts and a pool table, or that the beer was extra cold on Fridays. They did it because it was the only hope that their families and their community had for any kind of a future that wasn't utterly blighted and benighted.
And again,
well, it looks like it's time for us to shut down and break up. It's been a lot of fun. Guy James, thank you very much. Rick, thanks for stopping by.
I appreciate it, Bob, and I appreciate all the
work
you do.
Good to see you, Rick.
You too, Greg.
So that's it. That is it from Washington, D.C., from the Washington Court Hotel, live. Building.
You'll get it right.
The new economy.
There you go.
Making it in America. It's been a pleasure. And look for us back on Monday.
We'll be there.
You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. Bye, y'all.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you.